Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I've got an amazing guest today. He's a great guitar player, very smart, interesting guy, very clever, quick-witted. I'm not sure he's on the right show, but I'm very happy to have him here on the show. We're here with the one and only Greg Koch. Thank you so much, Greg. Let me read you Greg's background. Everybody knows Greg from the Wildwood videos, but there's more of him, and we're going to find out about it today. Okay, not a stretch to say that Milwaukee native Greg Koch is one of the most famous unknown guitar players in the world. His fierce creative spirit and crazed sense of fun, fused with a tremendous degree of versatility, has made him an island of six-string mirth in a sea of guitar warlords. This is like studying for the SAT exam. What the? Holy snap. Say that fast three times. 15 critically acclaimed CDs featuring his unique and incendiary brand of playing and composing. International tours as a band leader, 14 best-selling guitar instructional materials for the Hal Leonard Publishing Empire, articles and columns in some of the biggest guitar magazines, a lengthy past tenure as an tenure as an ambassador for Fender guitars, and a similar position in that capacity for Fishman transducers has generated a respectable following for Greg throughout the world. Ultimately, Greg's 4,000 plus videos, what have you been slacking? Exceeding 50 million views for Wildwood guitars. I'm going to say that again. 4,000 plus videos exceeding 50 million views. Man, I'd say work ethic is not an issue here, man. 4,000 videos. For Wildwood Guitars of Louisville, Colorado, showcasing Greg's wild guitar test drives and random humorous commentary have made him a household name for guitar players throughout the galaxy and here on Earth. Greg's latest musical outlet, the Koch Marshall Trio, is perhaps the best vehicle yet to convey his bold, improvisational explorations and ever-increasing arsenal of original material. The trio blends the explosive guitar manipulations of Greg, the groove-centric power pocket playing of his son Dylan on drums, and the two of them share many telepathic musical moments, and the glorious Hammond organ stylings of the uber-talented Toby Marshall. Greg's compositions are properly portrayed in the blues-drenched funk, chicken-fried, gospel-y jazz-rock panorama in which they were conceived. Their first release, Toby Arrives, will be released in the fall of 2017. Has that been out? Is that out yet?
Well, we got a record deal, so now it's been pushed back to 2018.
That never happens with record deals. Are you kidding? And features the first moments of their unexpected musical partnership captured at an extemporaneous jam session early in the year. I've never been exhausted at the end of reading a bio. We're done. Thank you for coming on the show. We'll talk to you next time. Man, thanks a lot, though. I really appreciate your time. It's great to have you here, man.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's do this. Let's get all the Wildwood questions out of the way first so we could focus on you for the bulk of the interview, because inquiring minds want to know this. So, you know, I try to put together a few questions that I would imagine people would want answers for if you're interested in answering the questions. And if you're not, that's totally cool, too. So, how long have you been working with Wildwood, and how'd you get the gig there in the first place?
I think it's about 4 or 5 years now.
And you've put out 4,000 videos in 4 or 5 years.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's initially when I would go out there. Well, what happened was originally is that, you know, Wildwood was always kind of way ahead of the curve on internet sales and having a website that, I mean, you know, 95% of their business is online, right? Mm-hmm. So they were one of the first places to really have the website that showed the guitars from every angle, each guitar photographed in full, you know, guitar porn splendor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had the weights and all the different minutiae of what people really want to know about guitars. And then Steve wanted to take it a step further of, well, wouldn't it be great to have someone come in and play these instruments? Because he has so many guitars in stock, you know, like a particular Fender Custom Shop guitar per se would have, you know, he might have, you know, 10 or 20 of them in that color. You know what I mean? Or so if someone's shopping, they could literally, which I've done actually before when I've shopped for guitars there, is, you know, put, you know, four or five of these videos up on your desktop and go from one to the next, and you can hear the differences between the guitars. So originally he wanted to have guys like me, and at that time I was doing a ton of Fender stuff. So his thought was, well, let's have Greg do the Fender stuff. Let's have Joe Blow, who does the stuff for Gibson, come out. And then, you know, maybe have David Grissom come out for Paul Reed Smith, or, you know, whatever the deal was. Have various different people from different manufacturers come in and do these videos. So Fender initially contacted me because I had done a clinic at Wildwood, oh, God, I'd say 10 years ago. And we did it with a trio. It was myself and Roscoe Beck and Tommy Breckline. We did a like a concert kind of a clinic for Wildwood back in the day, and that's where I met Steve. So Jeff Bowen, who was the Fender rep out there, called me up and said, hey, Steve from Wildwood would like you to come out, and he's got this idea for doing guitar videos. Are you interested? And I said, yeah. So Steve actually paid me a fee, and then Fender got me out there for the initial round. And I went out there, and we got in this studio where a lot of people recognize those, you know, that video set with all those amps in the background.
For sure.
And the first guitar I did was a Telecaster. And Steve said, yeah, this is what I'm basically thinking. I want you to just kind of go through all the pickup combinations and play something, you know, clean and with overdrive, and just kind of go through different styles and then give your impressions of the guitar. So I did one video. And by the time I got done with it, he just stood up and walked over to me. He goes, can I hire you to do these videos? I said, what do you mean? And he goes, I will fly you out here every month to do these videos. I said, you mean kind of like a job? He said, yeah. And at that time, what I thought was so funny was, you know, for 15 years, I did stuff for Fender all over the globe. And then that entire 15 years, I never had any official agreement. I never had any retainer. I never had any, it's like, oh, we're going to do X amount of events a year. It was always something I hobbled together through my various contacts at that company all over the world. And then towards the end of my relationship with them, I was trying to get them to have some kind of a centrally located place where they would say, okay, this is our plan for the year. We're going to do this. And I even attempted to help kind of massage that situation and make it easy for them. And in their corporate obliviousness, it just never happened. But yet the store in Louisville, Colorado said, yeah, we'll fly you out here every month to do these videos. And they said, okay, that sounds good. So initially when I went out there, 2 days a month, and we would do, we did about 35 videos a day originally.
Wow, wait a minute. You did 35 videos a day. So you're nailing this first take, some of these. There's no way you're doing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were all, the only time we started to kind of, you know, do little stops and edits was later on. They were all first takes. So you can hear me like tuning, you know, I would do a little initially. We would just go.
That's that's a lot of work, man.
Well, you know, I was so used to doing stuff like that in the Fender days, and that's just kind of how I roll, that it was kind of a perfect match. So wow.
I'm not blowing smoke up your ass, but there's not, you know, there's a skill set for this. It's not like anybody can come in here and make 35 videos in a day, let alone do that for 2 or 3 days or whatever. You know,
I appreciate that. I mean, it's something I enjoyed, but I've always been someone that I'm not extraordinarily picky when it comes to, you know, if I pick up a guitar and the action's a little weird or whatever, I'll find a way to make it work. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I always just enjoy guitars in general. So it didn't really, I can pretty much grab any guitar right off the rack and find a way to make it work. And that's part of the job description. So, after I started doing all this stuff for Fender and then in this period of time that I was doing stuff for Wildwood, you know, Fender still hadn't made my world any easier in terms of laying out any kind of plan for going forward. So finally, one day I said to Steve, I go, you know, I've played Gibsons all my life. I've owned Paul Reed Smiths. I love playing all those guitars. I play differently on those guitars. And quite frankly, if you wanted me to, I could probably start doing videos on those guitars. I don't think it really kind of affects what I do with Fender, which is becoming less and less anyway. So Steve said, well, I'll tell you what, if you would do these other videos for me, I could use you 6 days a month. So that's how that all ended up happening. So then I started going out there 6 days a month and just pounding out a metric shit ton of videos.
Well, and you do this every month.
I would do it every month. And then at some point we decided, okay, let's layer it down to 4 days a month. And then an extra 2 days a month, I just kind of do stuff online, and it's kind of more of a, additional stuff I might do from the home front. So I go out there 4 days a month to shoot the videos now.
How far is that from you?
It's a 2-hour flight. Oh, so typically what I do is I will fly early in the morning on a Monday and I usually land there around 7:30 in the a.m., and then we shoot videos all day, and then we go for 4 days straight. And at the end of Thursday, I fly back home and get home around 10 or 11 on Thursday night. So
are you like wasted on Friday? Are you wasted on Friday? I mean, just like you just got to decompress?
Well, you know, I've got 4 kids and
oh, wow. You are a glutton for punishment.
And in order to maintain my happy marriage, my wife of course, she's got a plate full, as you would imagine. When I'm traveling, she's juggling all the planes here on the home front. So she's got her own set of things. But because of my high energy level, like if I'm here and my eyes are open, she just assumes that I'm good to go. Even though there's times where I'm working on. I've literally come off the planes from Europe, landing at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and been in a parent teacher conference at an hour later. So,
wow.
But it just keeps going. You know what I mean?
Do you find, cause I have a high energy too, although I've definitely mellowed in the last few years as I've gotten older, but do you find when you have a high energy level that when you do shut down, it's almost like free falling like 10,000 feet because there's no, there's never a middle ground. You're either 100% on or zero.
Oh, absolutely. What will typically happen is that, the first day I get back from a trip or 2 days in, I'm still on the adrenaline rush, but all of a sudden I'll like hit the wall at like 6 o'clock at night or something like that. And I'll go to bed and I'll sleep for 12 hours and then I'm back.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I do know what you mean.
How it rolls.
Yeah. Interesting. But I just want to go over with people. That's 1,000 videos a year, roughly, which is, 3 a day. But if you're doing 4 days a month, it's 25 to 30 videos each of those 4 days. I've made videos online from marketing videos, not for guitars, but for other stuff. That's a ton of work, man. That's the tough thing about it is, and I write ad copy too. So the tough thing about it is, I would imagine, at a certain point in time, you run out of shit to say that's not, I said this in video 7 yesterday, and you don't want to repeat that, but some of it's got to be repeated because you're not describing, a woman in one video and a stapler in another video. They're all very closely related, and
yeah, there's a little bit of that. I mean, it's hard doing the playing. I mean, playing wise, I try to do things differently, but there's certain tunes that I end up referencing because what I learned over the period of time of doing the videos is that, when I get the guitars out of the box, they basically just hand them to me. And, it used to be that they'd tune them up for me. Lately, they don't even have a chance to tune them. So I get them and I'm tuning them up and away we go. So when you get a guitar that may have come in like a couple of months ago and has been sitting in a warehouse and you unpack it and you hand it to me, it's not staying in tune for love nor gold. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
And it doesn't pay for them to set the guitars up for me before I because they don't know what the end user wants. So it doesn't pay for them to set the guitars up. So I literally just have to wing it. So there are tunes that I will do that I know I can play on a guitar, even if the intonation's whacked or if the guitar's not staying in tune, I'll avoid open strings. There's kind of a whole different repertoire of stuff like that. So playing wise, there's one aspect of things, but then, what typically happens is I'll just riff on certain things will send me off. Like there might be certain numbers in the serial number that I'll go off on some kind of diatribe. Like, if there's three sixes, it's, you know, it's the beast's lute or something, or if it's got sevens, I'll, you know, whatever. Or if there's a certain color and the name of the color kind of will set me off on a tangent. So luckily there's enough stuff to work with both in the presentation of the guitar and whatever impressions I'll get kind of going in, or some of the syntax that's on the screen will usually be enough to kind of set me off on some kind of individual tangent that'll make that will make them all a little bit different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, that's got to be as much for the selling plus as for your own monotony's sake.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, I would imagine.
I mean, I do have fun doing it. Like, I got to be honest, I never wake up and be like, "Oh my god, I got to do videos today." I mean, I have a good time doing those things, and you know, back in when we'd be in, you know, this location that we were at, and I'm staring at, okay, we got to get 15 more done before the end of the day. That was a little daunting, but you know, hey, I'm getting paid to play the best guitars on earth, and I can play and pretty much say whatever I want as long as I don't get anybody in trouble, including myself. So, you know, as far as like jobs go, it's you know, it's pretty damn cool. You know what I mean?
And your energy comes across that you do like it, because you couldn't. I mean, there's no way you could be miserable and have that high energy level and over every single video anyway. So right. That's loud and clear. How much time do you spend with a guitar before you start shooting?
Literally, we'll tune and go.
So, wow. Okay. So you're just like, this is like all improv.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fantastic, man. No, that's great. I mean, that's not easy. That's awesome. All righty. So you're like obviously a very talented, you're a diverse player. Where did you learn to play? I mean, like, did you work with someone ever, or are you all self-taught? And if you, one way or another, what prompted you to pursue like all these different styles?
You know, I always studied with various different people, but most of the stuff I learned from records, as far as the stylistic stuff is concerned. I mean, theory things. And I mean, early on, I remember I had a guy that I just worked out of a method book with. And then there was another gentleman that I knew that I'm still friends with that I, you know, he was about 7 or 8 years older than I was. And he had been playing for a while. And I remember I would just ask him to play like Hendrix tunes. I'd like, play this tune, play that tune. And I would just so I could actually see someone doing it. And I mean, he would show me stuff, but even after the lesson was done, I would just say, can you play this and play that? And I would just watch him play those songs, because there was such a mystique about Hendrix and like Creamer or Clapton and Santana, you know, the guitar gods of that generation.
Sure.
Almost like it was like a metaphysical activity that was unobtainable. You know what I mean? So when I would actually see someone doing it, then I was like, well, okay, then it can be done and I'm going to do it.
Right,
so,
right.
But you know, I was the youngest of 7 kids. My brother was the oldest and I was the youngest, and there were 5 girls in between. So I had to room with my brother, who was like 14 years older than I was. So even though I was born in 66, my brother went to high school from 66 to 1970. So my first musical memories were him playing his records in our room. And so I grew up listening to, you know, Hendrix and Cream and the James Gang and the early Steve Miller Band and Graham Funk Railroad. And of course, the Beatles and the Stones and Allman Brothers and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But it was Hendrix and Cream that really did it for me. And I knew all about those guys. I mean, I did a report on Jimi Hendrix when I was in the 3rd grade. I just was, you know, to me, guitar player in a rock and roll band was cooler than anything. It was way cooler than any kind of sports figure, certainly cooler than any movie star. There was no one on earth that commanded as much you know, prestige in my eyes than a guitar player in a rock band. And Hendrix was the king of the kings, you know what I mean? Hmm. And a very close second would have been Creamy or Eric Clapton. So that's what I kind of aspired to. So when I first started, I've always wanted to play, but I didn't actually get my hands on a guitar until I was 12. And I'm starting to do these guitar clinics for Martin Guitars. There was a guy across the street that had a Martin HD28, and he showed me my first couple of chords. And once I learned a couple of chords, I borrowed a guitar from a girl that lived up the street who was a friend of my sister's, and I made up as many songs as I could, or sussed out as many songs as I could, just using like 2 chords. And I kept on saying to my dad, I want to take lessons. I want to take lessons. But I'd had, you know, through school, I had, you know, aborted efforts with, you know, the cello and the percussion kit. My dad's like, I paid rentals for all that other shit. I'm not going to play any, you know, it's not going to happen. So finally, after he saw I was just like relentless and practicing this, you know, whatever chords that I knew on this guitar, he's like, listen, I got a client of mine who's a guitar player. I'm going to have you have lessons with this guy. The moment he says that you're unprepared, I'm pulling the pin on this whole thing. So I made sure that I practiced religiously. And after 6 months of taking lessons with this guy came back to my dad and said, I can't teach him anything more. He knows everything because he was mostly a bass player and like a mandolin player, but he knew some guitar. So after 6 months, he got the report that I'd graduated past his skill level. So then my dad took it seriously. But, you know, one of the things that as far as the different styles and stuff were concerned, to me, all the roads were connected. I mean, you know, I Clapton led me to Albert Lee, and Albert Lee led me to James Burton and Chet Atkins and Jerry Reed and Jimmy Bryant. You know, Albert King and Hendrix and reading about Clapton also led me to, you know, all the blues guys from B.B. King to Albert King, Freddie King, you know, Otis Rush, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, all that kind of stuff. Which also somehow, you know, taking jazz band in high school led me to, you know, Wes Montgomery and Kenny Burrell and Grant Green and all that other kind of stuff. So getting exposed to all these different types of music, I felt they were all connected. But by the same token, is, you know, my dad was a lawyer, and I mean, I didn't grow up, you know, rich, but, you know, we definitely, you know, we weren't hurting from the aspect of, I grew up in an upper middle class home.
We also had seven kids, which was a lot of mouths. No matter how much money you make, you got seven kids. That's costly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My mom, obviously, she stayed home with the kids and so on and so forth. But my dad was very skeptical, and there were no other musician types in my family. And we certainly didn't come from a bohemian-esque background. So to be a musician, my dad thought I was going to work in a car wash. So he's like, you know, if you're going to do this thing, you better be as good as you possibly can. Or you're going to live in squalor. So that was definitely a motivating factor of, you know, I made sure that everything I did, I tried to do it to the extreme so that I would be able to be, you know, hopefully solvent someday. So sure. I think that was a big part of it, but I also loved it. I mean, practicing was never a chore for me. To this day, I mean, I get up in the morning and I start playing guitar. And if there weren't kids, you know, if there weren't bills to pay and, you know, a wife to talk to and, you know, a list to attend to when I'm down on the road, I just play guitar all day, you know?
Sure.
So, that's never really been work to me. So as a result, you know, I worked on all the different stuff and I continue to work, and it always comes in handy because then I have fresh content for the videos. Right. I have fresh content for instructional stuff should it come up. It inspires me to write songs. Every time I learn something from somebody else, I try to mutate it in some way to be in some way, put my own little stamp on it, whatever I can. So it all kind of ties together. I see it all as one, you know, all the different things I do, they're all interconnected. And so depending on what I'm doing, I can always justify it as like, well, I'm working on this, but I can also use it for this, that, and the next thing. So
yeah,
I hope that makes sense. It
does. And they always, you know, creatives, they always say nothing's lost.
Right.
You know, nothing is ever lost in any creative situation. Where did you get that work ethic from? I was curious, because did that come from your dad? Or, I mean, you have you're not doing all this. You know, you got to have a good work ethic to accomplish all this stuff.
Well, certainly. I mean, my mom and my dad worked their asses off. And certainly my family, I mean, they're all worker bees, you know? I mean, there's definitely no slackers in the bunch. And you know, and I married my wife's she's a worker bee. She's total, you know, she's a creative, she's a graphic designer, and she's a perfectionist. So it's just kind of the environment I'm in all the time. It's kind of like, you know, I always kind of joke. It's like I occasionally go out to lunch with friends. Other than that, I really have no there's no hobbies for me. You know what I mean? It's like I don't fish, I don't hunt, I don't play golf. I'm not on a baseball league. I don't bowl. You know, I reproduce and I practice. It's pretty It's kind of how I roll.
Both kind of fun things to do. So, I mean, it's all right.
Yes. Hey,
talk about playing with your son. That's got to be, I mean, I'm a dad. I got three kids. So that's got to be a really good experience, no?
Yes, it's been really fabulous. And what's great about this current situation is that it was, you know, pretty much my son's doing. I mean, you know, over the years, I mean, he gravitated to the drums early on. None of my kids really wanted to play guitar. I mean, I've shown them little things over the years and they all seem to like pick up on stuff really, really fast. But I think they're kind of like, well, that's dad's thing. So none of them really want to play guitar. But they, you know, he just always, like, when he was real young, he would grab, you know, like spoons and whatnot from the kitchen and just instinctively kind of feel where groove was. And he'd, like, even know where stops and starts were in songs that he had never listened to. It was always really bizarre, right? We'd have friends come over and they would just watch him as we were listening to music. And they're like, what's up with that kid? I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. So somewhere around the time when he was in fifth grade, he had a drum set early on, but around fifth grade, he really started playing more and, you know, practicing out in the garage. And then he started playing with little bands that I would kind of, you know, I would help kind of organize, and a couple of little young guitar virtuoso guys that he ended up playing with. And, the, you know, they would play festivals and were on TV and whatnot. But he was, you know, I remember specifically him sitting in with my band at a local gig. There's this local festival that happens every September. And it's the first time he really sat in with the band at a big gig type of situation. And I remember him coming up. I said, what do you want to play? He goes, let's play that Band of Gypsies song, Message to Love, which is
not
an easy song to play.
By a long shot.
And he was probably 15 or 16 at the time. And the video is on YouTube, as a matter of fact. You can see it. And he nailed
Hold on a minute. Where would that be? Because I think people are going to want to see that.
If you just search my name and, you know.
Message to Love?
Message to Love.
Okay. So check out YouTube and look up Greg Koch. It's Greg, G-R-E-G, Koch, C-O-C-H, and look up Message to Love.
K-O-C-H.
I'm sorry, K-O-C-H. I'm looking at it.
Like the old mayor of New York, although I'm not related to him either.
So. How am I doing? That's what he used to say. He used to run around saying, how am I doing all the time?
Yeah, exactly.
So, and then check it out, Message to Love, and it'll be a video of Greg and his son. Okay, sorry, man. I just think people would want that.
Anyway, so then we started doing some various different things over the years. Later on, I think that next year we were out at NAMM, and he came along because he was kind of looking at some possible music schools to go to in Southern California. And him and I and Roscoe Beck got up, and we played at the Fender booth kind of unexpectedly. And that blew up on YouTube as well. And so then it became kind of a thing. And he played on a record that I did called Plays Well With Others. And, you know, Robin Ford's on that record and Paul Barrere from Little Feet and John Cleary and Roscoe Beck and so on and so forth. So he got to play, needless to say, with some cool people. In that particular session, he played with Paul Barrere. He was a huge Little Feet fan, so
that
was
nice. Cool that yeah.
But then he went to school at the school up in Minnesota, McNally Smith College of Music, which actually made I started to become faculty. I was up there 2 days a week, and I was full time faculty. And then my son got to go to school for free, which was great.
Wow, that's very cool.
Although that doing everything else I was doing was enough to make me have a nervous breakdown, so I only did that for a year.
Right.
And then my son decided to stop going to school there, but he has just been doing gigs here, there, the next place. And then one day he said, hey, you got to check out this organ player, that I've been playing with up in Minneapolis. And so this organ player, Toby Lee Marshall, he came down to visit because he was buying a Leslie speaker down here in Milwaukee. Just so the people don't know, Minneapolis is about 5 hours away from Milwaukee. It's kind of a
I was going to ask you that. Yeah, I thought so.
So he came down, and my son's like, hey, are we going to jam with Toby? We're going to jam with Toby. And I'm like, yeah, I guess. You know, I don't, you know, last thing you want to do when I'm off the road is just kind of do a random jam. You know what I mean? But yeah. My son was pretty insistent. So I called up a studio that I knew had a B3, and I arranged a session. Toby came to the house. We went over to this place. The very first song that we played, we plugged in. Plugged the guitar into an amp and made sure I had a sound. And I said, hey, let's just do a shuffle in G. And it was recorded. That's the first tune on the CD. It was so good right from
the
get-go. The very first tune we ever played is the first track on the record. And then the second tune on the record is the second tune we ever played. So
like the demo became the master.
Exactly.
Wow. And, that's pretty cool, man.
And it just kind of went from there. And then we just were doing gigs as the three piece. And a lot of my other stuff has vocals, but this is just, it's instrumental music, but it's so accessible because it's kind of like Booker T and the MGs meets Deep Purple on the highway to Jimmy Smith. It rocks, but it's funky. And there's that chicken picking aspect, but it's just so powerful that you're, you know, we're singing with our instruments. There doesn't need to be any vocals. Anyway, so the people at, the Mascot Label Group decided that they saw it that way too. So they just signed us. So we're coming out with that record on that label, which is a great label. It's the one that Joe Bonamassa stuff is distributed by, and Robin Ford's on that label. And, you know, everyone from Eric Gales to JD Simo, all these different people are all on that label. So
that's fantastic.
It's really awesome. So yeah. So it was my son's doing that it all kind of came together. So, and plus they signed the whole band. They just didn't sign me, which is even cooler. Yeah. So
your son's must be thrilled.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's he's 22 great. And he's got a record deal.
Yeah,
so.
Good for him, man. That's nice. Really nice. And that's really special, man. You're originally from Milwaukee, correct?
Yes.
And you grew up there, seven kids in your family. That is amazing, man. I mean, I couldn't imagine seven kids in one household. You start playing guitar, but what happens? Finish your story. So you start playing guitar. Your dad gives you lessons. You're obviously kicking ass.
Well, what was interesting is that I was kind of going to follow the path of my dad and be a lawyer. That was the goal. So I went to this kind of hoity-toity college prep high school. But by then, by eighth grade, I'd started playing guitar, and that's all I wanted to do. It's like I knew I was thunderstruck. I was like, this is my destiny. This is what I'm going to do.
By eighth grade?
By eighth grade, I knew it. So freshman year... I started screwing off in school, didn't do very well. I painted myself into a corner. Let's put it that way. So, and there were people that really got the fact that I obviously had some kind of predisposition to this, but I was always kind of an outcast from the point of view of, you know, I never kind of played by the rules in terms of, oh, let's be a nice, you know, be good and play jazz like it's supposed to be played. It's like jazz people made me irritable as hell because they thought anybody that bent a string was a heretic. You know what I mean? Well, that only wanted me to play louder and bend more. So, although I did like jazz and I, you know, I obviously learned it, to the extent that I added to what I do. But, anyway, so
is it safe to say you just don't like being told what to do? Because I'm like that. I'm like, when you said that resonated with me because I don't know so much now, maybe, but you know, if someone tells me, you know, don't do this, even, you know, if I wasn't planning on doing it, now I'm going to freaking do it just because you had to be an asshole and tell me not to do it.
That's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I understand that.
I think I play all the different styles because if I'm immersing myself in one style and kind of interacting with those folks and someone pisses me off or some situation rubs me the wrong way, I'm like, yeah, I'm going over here for a while.
Yeah. No, I totally understand that. It's a blessing and a curse, actually, and I totally get it.
It is. So I went to high school, did my thing, and then, of course, you got to go to college. Where are you going to go to college? So I ended up going to a state school that for jazz guitar performance, University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. The guy that actually ran the music department up there was a guitar player, and I had met him at a summer camp that I actually got a scholarship to go to when I was in high school. I went to a different high school for my junior and senior year, and that band director was a lot more open to the way I played and was very supportive and would feature me in various different groups and got me that scholarship to that jazz camp. And while I was at this jazz camp, I met this guitar player who was like, hey, I really like the blues stuff and the kind of chicken picking thing you're doing. If you wanted to expand it with a little bit more of jazz stuff, you should check out this guy, Larry Carlton and Robin Ford. And so he was much more open. Well, it turned out that same individual ran the jazz department, at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. So that was a good place for me to go because for the period of time that I was there, it was a very inclusive place for me to just kind of, and I didn't want to be, you know, a guy that was going to play an ES-175 with flat wound strings into a polytone amp and play all, you know 60 standards by heart and play on the Lido deck of some cruise ship at some point. I just wanted to be, not that there's anything wrong with that,
that wasn't you.
That wasn't me. Yeah. But I want to know how to be able to be musically literate in terms of being able to transcribe stuff to the extent that I needed to be able to read. And to be able to have the theoretical knowledge to be able to solo over more complex harmonies than just diatonic stuff. So I did learn that. And so that was all good. So from there, I ended up, I was in Minneapolis for a brief period of time. That's where my wife is from. I met her up there. But I went back to Milwaukee because I had already kind of had an inroad with various different musicians and already had kind of a pathway, because I wanted to always have my own band. I never really wanted to be a sideman per se. I wanted to have my own band doing my own original material. And my thought process was, is that if I made a splash in my hometown and became kind of a big fish in a small pond, that would be my insurance policy after I made my forays into the real world. I would always have this home turf that I could, you know, harvest for whatever I needed to. It sounds a lot more calculated than I really had in mind, but it more or less has worked out.
No, so. But it sounds like it was at least something. You know, when you're that age, it's that you even thought of that is actually pretty commendable looking back. I mean, you know, who thinks of that stuff when they're that young? I certainly was, and I thought it was pretty commendable that you thought, okay, well, at least I have a plan B here if something fails, and I can make a living.
Right.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good, actually.
And so it all panned out for, you know, it's my situation is I've been very, very fortunate, and, you know, yes, I've practiced, and but I just situations became available to me, and I just took advantage of the stuff that was in front of me, and I've never really been a big complainer for the most part. And there's a lot of stuff over the years that, you know, I could have said no to, that didn't seem like a good fit to begin with, but because I had said yes, it led to all kinds of other different things. So I've been very, very fortunate. You know, I mean, I make a decent living. I'm not gone all the time. I pretty much get to say and play whatever I want. My wife, you know, she's still around, which is miraculous. And
how long you been married? I was going to ask you that, because you've been together 30 years, probably, no?
Well, we've been married for, Dylan's going to be 23. We've been married 24 years.
Right. And how long you been together?
Probably 30 years. You're right.
Yeah. Man, congratulations. People don't realize I've been with my wife 25 years. That's a major.
Yes.
Major. Because it's not, and especially raising kids, that is not easy, man. It's a lot of commitment and a lot of give and take, and you have to be on the same team, you know. And I'm sure it's the same thing for you guys. You start to see people our age, like, and you know, they're either divorcing or you're finding out, you know, oh, well, you know, they haven't slept in the same room for 20 years, or, you know, he's got his mistress, which I almost, like, in a sense, not admire that, but, like, I have trouble living one life with one woman. Like, I find it overwhelming. I'm almost like, wow, man, you know, how can I get that skill set but put it to good use? Like, how do you juggle? Like, you know.
I agree with you. I wonder the same thing. I have friends like that, too, where you're like, how is that even possible?
Maybe I'm just weak in character. I'm overwhelmed with the one. The thought of having a second or a third be like, it's like a good case study. Maybe I could use that in like a business situation or something. I don't know. But anyway, my point is, congratulations. That's really cool.
Oh, yeah. You know, I lucked out too. I mean, she's a champion. And, you know, for the most part, you know what I think is one of the things, because, you know, some folks ask, you know, well, like my wife she might go to take two gigs I do a year. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. If she listens to 30 seconds of one of my songs, that's probably a long time.
Sure.
It's not that she doesn't like it. She respects it from an artistic point of view because she herself is an artist. I think one of the reasons why our whole situation has worked is because from the get-go, she liked me because of me, not because I was a musician.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that had nothing to do with it. And as a matter of fact, I remember I always tell the story about how, you know, we were up in Minneapolis at the time, and she grew up in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And when I was – one of my college jobs was playing at this theme park south of Minneapolis called Valley Fair. And a bunch of people from our music department got jobs, and there were like four or five different bands that played at this theme park for the summer. So it was a good summer gig. So I was playing in this, you know, group that did a Whitney Houston / country medley. And then the evenings we were off, and one day I was in this music store and I was messing around with a guitar, and this guy came over to me and said, hey, are you in a band? And I said, well, I play at the theme park during the day, but I'm off at night. And he goes, well, I need a guitar player to sit in for the first set on Saturday night. Can you do it? I said, absolutely. I said, what's the name of the band? And he goes, well, my name's Pat Hayes, and the name of the band is Lamont Cranston. Well, Lamont Cranston for years was like the blues band in the Twin Cities. And they had opened up for the Stones. They had like a top 10 at one point in time, the Upper Mississippi Shakedown. And so everyone knew who this band was. So I couldn't wait to go home and rub it into my roommates' faces. So I went back and I said, hey, dudes, I got a gig Saturday night. Where? Who's with? Lamont Cranston. They're like, no way, man. I'm like, yeah. So then I call up this new girl that I'm going out with. And I say, hey, you want to come to my gig on Saturday night? She's like, yeah, where are you playing? I'm playing over at the such and such ballroom. She's like, who's it with? And I said, Lamont Cranston. And she goes, who the fuck is that?
Nice. Perfect. Gotta love it.
She's the one.
Yeah, man. I hear that. I hear you. Yeah. No, I know. You know, I think there's something to that because I think if you're too involved with each other's stuff, maybe it's, I don't know, because it's the same in my house. Like last night I got a phone call. I'm like, and I was trying to connect with somebody else. I'm like, wow, I got this call. And I was about to say something to my wife. She goes, is it important? I'm like, well, fuck to me, it's important. Right. And she's like, okay. Like, I'll suffer through it because I love you, but like, don't make it, you know, mind your time. I'm, you know, I was like, so I understand that and it's worked, you know, and I think it's right. Probably, you know, I totally get it. I totally get it, man. You know, so, but it's difficult. So congratulations. That is a big thing to be together that long, man. And you sound actually happy. So, which is really cool.
Well, I married up, you know, as you do.
Yeah. Oh, believe me, I do know that. Because I'm the same. If you can go back and give advice to younger Greg Koch, what advice would you have given?
Oh boy, I think more than anything else that I've learned is that you know, when people say you can't care what other people think. I mean, that's a little bit of a weird thing to say, because obviously you have to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, you have to be aware of the situation of what people like and what they don't like. But I think more than anything else, when I was younger, I thought that there was, at some point you ran across a crowd or a level of expertise in an industry that there's like somewhat of a quality threshold, or that there was some kind of consensus as to what was good and what wasn't. And then once you reached that area, then you were kind of in like Flynn. And then what I really realized that no one really has a clue for the most part, and that it's all for the vast majority of people. It's hearsay and propaganda that they sell more than anything else. And that's not saying that I know more than anybody else. I'm just saying that you just do what you do to the best of your ability and not worry about what anybody else thinks, because if you're doing it for the right reasons in your work and you treat people right, stuff's going to pan out. But if you constantly think, oh, I got to do this and this and this, and hopefully that person will like it, or wait till this person hears me, they're really going to get it. That's really where I wasted a lot of time. And I think a lot of people do, you know, you think, you know, for instance, you know, oh, if my idol hears my music, they're going to hear what I got from their music, and they're going to say, well, of course I'm going to help this individual because he's influenced by me, and boy, I'm going to be great, and I'm going to help that person along and do that. And of course, these people have their own problems, their own world. They have their head up their own ass. They're not going to be able to hear your influence in there, or maybe, you know what I mean?
It's
just a series of misconceptions in that regard. So that's the thing I would say more than anything else, is that don't pay any attention to anybody else. Just do your thing. Work hard and treat people right, and things will be fine. As opposed to, you know, and that's another thing too, is that you always think that, oh, if someone's going to hear me, they're going to pluck me out, and you know, there's going to be that there's some kind of free lunch at some point, that there's going to be, you know, and that's not to say that there aren't situations where you hear people getting, you know, with some kind of shall we say, pronounced skill in one way, or a great song, or a great particular lineup, that all of a sudden doors open for them quickly. But that's the exception and not the rule. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that there's a lot of people, including myself, when they're younger, like, oh my God, I'm hot shit at a young age. Certainly at some point, someone's going to hear me. and it's going to be all over. And realize, like, no, you got to do it all yourself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Totally. So, it's on us as individuals. You know, you can't. It's a wishful. Maybe it comes from, I don't know, growing up with parents. I don't know, but you know, it's on us to make our lives happen. And when it comes down to it, or not happen.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, you do have. I think people often look at like, I don't know. Let's take in business. You know, people look at the iPhone. They'll say, "Well, look how the iPhone took off." I mean, that's like 1 in 100 million businesses.
Right.
And it's probably the same situation where, you know, I was walking down the street and I bumped into, you know, Ritchie Blackmore. And, you know, we had this, yeah, that doesn't happen really in real life. Exactly. It really honestly doesn't. It's like nice on television, but, you know, you got to struggle and grind it out and grind it out and grind it out. And if you keep grinding it out enough and in the right direction, something will happen. And then it'll grind out at the next level, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I know what you mean.
So, I consider myself very fortunate that I did not have anything kind of meteoric happen as a youngster, because I think that would have ruined me. I mean, you know, because you have these delusions of grandeur, and unfortunately, you know, there's more than enough stories of people who, you know, all of a sudden they are plucked out for whatever reason. And then you hear, you know, let's be honest, more stories than not of musicians, whether they're well-known or not, are tales of woe. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%. Or you don't even hear the stories of the, again, the 99.99% other guys who don't even get to the level of be a tales of woe.
Exactly.
You know, that's the, you know, the hidden side of it. So I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know if you can answer it in your position at Wildwood or in your position as, you know, the guitar dude that you are. Is there a guitar, in your opinion, or a genre or style of guitars that are definitely underrated and overrated?
You mean manufacturer-wise, a kind of?
Yeah, like play. Like, is there a guitar that you say, "Man, this guitar is such a monster," and I don't know why people don't know it's a monster when instead everybody focuses on blah blah blah, and the corollary of that, you know, man, this guitar is a piece of shit, and I don't know why so many people are in love with it.
Well, I let me put it this way, you know, the iconic brands, they have the advantage of, I mean, there are people that say, for instance, Paul Reed Smith always bemoans the fact, I mean, I haven't heard him say this directly, but, you know, I've heard that he has said this, that his biggest drawback of him owning his company is that none of his instruments were made in time to be played at Woodstock, because all of the guitars that got played at Woodstock had since become iconic instruments that everyone knows the look and sound of, and people have to have that sound.
Do you think Woodstock had to do with that, or like just a whole?
Yeah, you know, certainly, you know, Hendrix playing, you know, a Strat at Woodstock, and SG's being played by
Santana,
and Joe Cocker's band. Like, I remember that Gold Top that guy played, and Delvin Lee playing the Red 335,
right.
And so on and so on and so forth. But just his point is that era of people, you know, the 60s era pretty much defined what electric guitars would be iconic. And so of those guitars, the big advantage they have is that no one makes, for instance, a Gibson Les Paul like the Gibson Custom Shop. No one makes a Fender Strat like the Fender Custom Shop. There are other companies that can do more of an individual one-off thing, but because those manufacturers have the ability to buy, to have the original machinery or to have the original source for a bunch of the different materials that are used, and can buy it in the unbelievable quantity that's necessary to have those guitars be made. That being said, you know, some of those guitars are, you know, they're, some of the prices are a little ridiculous, but I will say that people say, well, what about Strats? I mean, what would you say about what's the best Strat in the world? And I'm like, well, Fender, you know, if you want a Fender Stratocaster, The Fender Custom Shop, particularly a master-built one, is going to be, statistically speaking, a superior sounding and playing instrument, and it's going to maintain its value more so than any other, shall we say, boutique-ish iteration of a Strat.
Like a Sur or something like that. Like a Sur, S-U-H-R, yeah.
Correct. Although of the other, but I've also had a chance to play some of these more boutique-ish ones, and they're all great. You know, there's some really good guitars. But one in particular that I get to play it every time that I play one, I say to myself, if I was doing sessions all day long and I needed to play hard rock 1 minute, you know, funk the next, some kind of poppy thing the next, or some kind of ethereal thing the next, and I needed a guitar with a tremolo arm that did what a Strat did but stayed in tune and the intonation was spot on, I'd say without hesitation I'd get a James Tyler, because those guitars and those videos, when I get them out of the box and I play it, I can treat that thing like a farm animal from the get-go. And I can do whatever on the whammy bar, and it stays in tune, and I can go anywhere on the neck, and the thing is intonated perfectly. And it actually sounds more like a Strat than some of these other boutique manufacturers that sound more like a modern Strat, a little bit more antiseptic sounding. And there's something about what James Tyler does. I don't know what he does, but that's what I would say as far as – that's an example of
– Where is he out of, Greg?
He's an L.A. guy.
You know what? I've never even heard of that. But there's a lot of brands out west I haven't heard of, actually.
Anyway, so James Tyler, his guitars are known because he's got that weird headstock. It kind of looks like someone's getting flipped off. And so a lot of people are repelled by his headstock. So every time, and he's got really weird paint jobs. So the look of the guitar isn't something – that is really my cup of tea, but as a tool, especially as a Strat, you know what I mean? If you want to play whammy bar stuff and stay in tune and be able to do chordal stuff and have the, because on a regular Strat, there's always this dialogue going on in your head. You know, of course, maybe other people don't hear voices in their head, but when I'm playing a Strat, and I did for many years, you're like, oh, I'd really like to do this tremolo part or this part with the whammy bar here. And when I do the solo, I'd like to go for it a little bit more with the whammy bar. But I know towards the end of the song, I got to do this arpeggiated part with open strings. And if I do that stuff, I'm running a danger of the guitar is going to be out of tune. So you're constantly editing yourself. There's this dialogue going on when you're playing more of a traditional Strat as to when and where you can really go hog wild on the whammy bar. But on those James Tyler guitars, the way that they're set up from the get-go, they're just totally meant to be abused.
I'll have to check those out.
And I should also preface this with the fact that I'm not like MacGyver with my guitars either. You know, a lot of guys are really into always tweaking them and are always, you know, and with a Strat, and you know, if you're playing a traditional Strat and really using the tremolo a lot and having a floating whammy bar and that kind of stuff, you really kind of got to be kind of a tinkerer, and I am definitely not. So for the non-tinkerer in me, James Tyler is set up for abuse.
But, you know, it's really weird that you said that his, you know, the shape or the headstock and this and that, the colors, because, like, I've talked to loads of boutique guys, and, you know, they'll all tell you, man, if you're not making something that looks like a Strat or a Les Paul, it ain't going to sell.
Right.
You know, I mean, because people don't gravitate to something that looks like, you know, a... I don't know, whatever, you know, a Star or something like that, you know?
Right.
So I'm surprised that he's got such a good product, but doesn't make it a little more conventional. I get the whole unconventional thing, but when it comes to making money, you know, it's interesting that he wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely looks, I mean, there's a Strat body shape, but just the headstock is just it repels people, but they sell. I mean, they get him into, he doesn't make a whole lot of guitars. I think that's part of it.
Okay.
So, but every time their guitars come into Wildwood, they are in and they are out of their lickety split.
Okay.
It just, boom, they're gone.
Thanks for talking about that. That was very interesting. What on you, just you personally, what's your go-to guitar, and maybe what other two guitars would round out your top three?
I'm a Tele guy 90% of the time, 99% of the time. I gravitate more to I played Strats for years, and I like playing Strat, but to me, it's just, I like the purity of what a Tele does. And my formative guitar for many years when I was a youngster was a Tele, and it's kind of the perfect palette for what I do. It's a very pure sound, and I can make it do whatever I want to do. And there's just something honest and cool about it. I like the way it looks. I can treat it like a farm animal, and in a post-apocalyptic world, there will be Telecasters and cockroaches.
There you go, man.
Tellies will be in tune. So I gravitate towards Telly. I did recently, in the last year, I bought a 53 Telly after many years of denying myself having an old guitar. I broke down and I found one that was it was a spray over, so it's not, you know, it's not all 100%. I mean, it looks like a regular 53 Telly, but it's and it is for all intents and purposes. But at some point, someone put a lacquer over. So, but it was done so long ago, you can't even tell. But that saved me about $20,000.
Oh yeah, you're literally the second or third person now in 3 days I've spoke to who has a lot of guitars and went and bought a 53 Telly. I'm sure you know Greg Martin from the Kentucky Headhunters.
Yeah,
I know Greg. And so I was asking him, because he said, oh man, I just got this 53 Telly, and he showed it to me and it friggin' looked great. I said, yeah, but don't you have a 57? He goes, I do. I said, well, what's the difference? He goes, the Tadeo Gomez neck. And he said, they just sound spankier. There's something about it. They sound spankier. And then I just spoke to an A-list, like a first call session guy in Nashville. I don't know if you know him. I'm having a brain fart now because I'm talking to too many people. Sorry, Derek Wells?
I don't know Derek.
Yeah, no. Real nice guy. And I mean, he's been at this forever. But he's got a 53 Telly. And he said the same thing. Because it's just got that special... You know, because he's probably got 30 or 40 guitars as a session guy, right. And but that's his like. He said, "I will never part with it. It's my. I have that and an original 61 SG, and those are my two. You know, right. Going to my grave with me." So I've just been hearing about this 53 Telly, so it's got me curious. Not that I'll ever buy one. I can't justify it because I'm not a professional player or anything. But
there's a sound to them and there's a feel to them, and it's got the. I mean, everyone thinks of Tellies as being really, really bright, but with the older Telly, especially this 53, there's a sponginess to the top end. So when you land, that you get that Telly sound, but it's kind of like it's the velvet ice pick. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
It's and the neck pickup's real squishy. It just it's killer, and it weighs nothing. It's just it plays great. And then I also bought a we think it's a 55 Les Paul, but it's a factory refin. So the headstock serial number starts with a 6. So we were always saying it was a 56 Les Paul, but it's got the wraparound tailpiece with the P90s. So for all intents and purposes, it's either a 54 or a 55. But that guitar
burst. It's a burst.
It's red. So would have been a gold top. So it was refinned and it's this transparent, like sweet cherry. It's glorious, and it sounds – because I played it with Steve's from Wildwood. He sold it to me, and it is he's got also a 54 all-original gold top, and I played that one, and then I played the red one. The red one kills it. It's unbelievable. So after many, many years of not having the stuff, I finally broke down, and I got rid of a lot of custom shop stuff to get these two guitars, but it was worth it.
That's awesome, man. That's really good. You have any guitars that have like cool or interesting stories behind them, how you acquired them?
Oh boy. You know, I did two custom shop guitars that I've had for a long time that actually a store locally did a kind of a signature run of these guitars. One's a Telly, one's a Strat. They did 10 of each master built, and they were not cheap, but the original one I bought back in the day, this is when the Fender Custom Shop first started. I think the Fender Custom Shop started maybe 1989-ish. And I ordered this guitar in either 1990 or 91. And it was made by Jay Black. And at that time, they were all master-built guitars. You just literally made an order of what you wanted, and they made it for you. They didn't have like a run of guitars that the custom shop would do. You had to order it special. So
what did that cost back in 89, if you're okay saying?
I think it was $1,300.
Wow. Which was a lot. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's probably like, you know, $5,000-$6,000 now.
Yeah, it was. I remember it was definitely at least half of what it would have been for me to get an original one. Because I wanted, a buddy of mine had a 56 Strat that had a big neck on it. And he was hip to the vintage thing before everybody else was, and had a whole bunch of old guitars. And this one he had put bigger frets in. And so when I'd do gigs with him, he'd let me play that guitar, and I loved it. And I wanted that guitar, but there was no way I could afford it. So I ordered from the custom shop. I wanted 22 frets instead of 21, and I wanted a flatter radius and taller frets. And I loved Sonic Blue. So I wanted a
I love that color, man. Yeah.
Yeah. I did transparent Sonic Blue. I wanted the mother of toilet seat pickguard. I wanted gold hardware. So I've had that guitar.
Mother of toilet seat pickguard.
Yeah.
I'm listening.
As a matter of fact, this is it right here. I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah, man. That's awesome. Very cool. So that is a replica of that's a custom shop 56 Strat.
That is correct. And it's got a different neck on it now because my original neck, which was a flame maple neck, which is beautiful, the truss rod got stripped. So a buddy of mine from the custom shop said, you know what, I'm just going to make you an exact duplicate of that neck, but I'm just going to make it out of nice rock hard maple so that it won't have to be adjusted as much. Because as much as the curly stuff looks great, it's more unstable. So he made me another neck for it. And so I had that guitar, and then I kind of based the look on this one from a guy who about 6 months earlier ordered a Telecaster with a B-bender from the Fender Custom Shop. And when that guitar came in and I saw it, it was also Sonic Blue, had a matching headstock, B-bender, mother toilet seat pickguard, gold hardware. I said, I want my Strat to look like that. Well, a few years later, the guy that owned that Tele said, hey, how'd you like to buy the Tele and have a matching set? And so I ended up buying that. So these two guitars I've had the longest. I haven't been real attached, other than my Martin that I bought in 1996.
Where'd you get that?
That one I bought at a music store in town here. I was doing a bunch of sessions, and I would always borrow guitars. I was buying borrowing a D35 from one friend, an HD28 from somebody else. And I was trying different Martins at all these different stores, and I walked into the Uncle Bob's Music here in Milwaukee, and I picked up this guitar, and I started playing it, and the guy that worked there was like, this one is the one. So I used it for a session, and I heard it, what it sounded like, and I was like, I got to buy it. So I did it. It was actually called a Custom 15, which I did a little research on, and Martin made from like the late 80s through 1995-ish. They made something called a Custom 15, but it was actually an HD28. So it was made more like a pre-war Martin.
Yeah, yeah.
Had the V-neck and the open tuners, and it sounds glorious. And so that's been my main acoustic forever. But now that I'm starting to do stuff for Martin, I really got a hankered for it. I've got an ON28 here that I really like, and I'm going to try a triple O. So I think I'm going to – I want something with a little bit of bling on it, so I'll probably end up doing either a triple O41 or an OM41 or OM45, depending on. I'm going to see if I like that shorter scale with the triple O versus the OM, and then I'm going to pull the pin.
Okay, so here's something that for companies out there. So what you need to do is start figuring out what guitar Greg likes, because in 2 years, if you want to hire him, I'm noticing the pattern now. You know, I need a Martin. Oh, I'm doing a gig for Martin now. Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect. So all you companies out there, if you're smart and you have a sense of awareness, listen to him. He'll slowly tell you. 6 months, you'll hear it mentioned once. Then in another month, and maybe twice. And you start thinking, man, I'm going to get this guy right here. You ever sell a guitar you wish you can get back?
Yeah. I had my first guitar that I ever played a bunch was a 68 Tele. And I sold it. I don't know why the hell I sold that guitar. You know, because at that time I wanted a Strat, and because, you know, I ended up with a Tele, not because at the time all my favorite guys were Tele guys. It was just the Fender guitar that was available to me. My guitar teacher was selling a 68 Tele. And I was like, okay, I'll get that. And I loved the sound of the neck pickup on the Tele. And if, you know, you had kind of the whole, you know, the all-in-one channel switching of just, you know, you start your solo on the neck pickup, and then you go to the bridge pickup and take it over the top. So the Tele just ergonomically worked for me because that was the guitar that was available to me. And then for some reason, I was like, one day I'm going to get a Strat because that's my thing. I'm going to get a Strat. So I ended up selling that 68 Tele, and I sold it to a guy who like routed it and put humbuckers in it.
Horrible. Hey, you do a lot of, you're really good with it too. You do a lot of finger picking. If somebody is listening to this and like, what's one or two shortcuts? Cause loads of guitarists listen to this, obviously. What's one or two shortcuts, or not even shortcuts, these are under shortcuts. What are one or two things that can help somebody become a better finger picker besides obviously practice without a pick?
Well, you know, most of my stuff I do with picking fingers. I always say that if, you know, like the Chet Atkins school of playing, you know, Chet and Merle Travis and Jerry Reed, all those guys use thumb picks, and all of their kind of acolytes, you know, from Tommy Emmanuel to, Brent Mason, all of these guys, there's a level of right hand ferocity that you can do with a thumb, pick, and fingers that is very hard to do with pick and fingers. Let's put it that way. So if I could do it all over again and I really wanted to get into start playing and really embrace that finger style way of playing, I would start off with a thumb pick and just force myself to do it. By the time I got into that style, I was already using a pick and fingers. And I did try moving towards the thumb pick, but it was just too much of a difference, and plus I didn't want to be able to lose out on all the cool nuanced stuff that I knew how to do with the flat pick. So I just forced myself to try to replicate as much as I possibly could the vibe of playing with the thumb pick with my pick and fingers, but that was definitely the harder way to go. But so I say, if you want to get into that style of playing, you could do yourself a huge favor by just forcing yourself to use a thumb pick, because it'll be easier in the long run.
It's really awkward to do that, Bo. Yeah. And then you look at a guy like Jeff Beck, and it's not even human what he does. I mean, I don't understand anything what he does. The noises he makes.
Jeff Beck is a unique case. You know, totally. I mean, he's a guy that, and I'm a huge Jeff Beck fan. He's created his own voice and even refined it more, and continues to evolve creating that voice. But when he's playing like a vocalist. So he doesn't really have to worry about comping for the majority of the tune or coming up with a bunch of different tones. He just does his thing. You know what I mean? Mm. And therefore, he can really fine tune it. And you know what I mean by that? I mean, he's not worried about, well, I can't have the floating tremolo so much on this song because I have to cover this part and this part and this part. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He does his thing, and it's glorious beyond all measure. But it's not as he's not really different because he's picked a lane. It's the most glorious lane, perhaps, on the planet, but it's one lane. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But I'm just amazed how he does what he does. It's just like floors me.
One of the best guitar lessons I ever had was I went to go see Jeff Beck, and I had like a general admission ticket, and it was in Milwaukee. It was just like 1998, maybe 99, something like that, somewhere in that neck of the woods. And this couple comes up to me and they said, "We just got a call from our babysitter. We got to go home, but we're big fans of yours. We would love it if you'd take our ticket. It's second row."
Wow.
So I went from being in the nosebleeds or, you know, out in the general admission stuff, and I walked into this roped off area that was the only kind of, seated area.
Holy crap.
And I learned more shit from watching him in that period of time. Just, you know, all these little nuanced things that he does that you hear on record, like, what the hell is he doing? And I was like, aha.
And so, you know what? I heard, I don't know if this is true because I never saw him in concert, but I heard that Roy Buchanan used to turn around when he was playing because he didn't want anybody to know his secrets. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know if you've ever seen Roy, but
I never saw him live, but I'm a big Roy fan. There's some footage online where you can, you know, it doesn't look like he hides. I heard Eddie Van Halen used to do that too, like early on, like when he would do the tapping stuff, he would turn around so no one could see him. But who knows? You know, most of Roy's stuff is so hard to do anyway that, you know,
Yeah, like, who? Go ahead, watch, you know, go ahead, if you could do. But you know what's weird, though? There's some really, like, horrific sounding, like, there's some stuff online with Roy. It was like, you know, the first video camera ever made, you right. know, four rows or six rows back, and he's got, like, you know, an amp they found lying across the street there, plugged in on a stage and in a horrible setting, and he still sounds great. That's the thing with it. I mean, that guy was just phenomenal.
He was magical.
Hey, tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or would find a little odd.
Well, I don't party at all. That's what people might find odd. I mean, I did. I used to. But, I mean, that's been 22 years. Mm. So... yeah, I'm a sober guy, so there's no partying there, you know, like, because a lot of people, I think, you know, like, oh, I'd like to have a beer with Greg. It's like, yeah, well, that doesn't happen. So,
no, but you know what? You can't operate at this intensity level of energy that you do at this age. Not that you're old, but we're the same age, roughly. I'm 3 years older than you, but you can't operate at this age cranking like this, you know.
True. Although you'd be surprised. I mean, I know a lot of guys that I mean, who are not necessarily, well, there's some functioning musicians, but people in the business, shall we say, that I interact with that, mm-hmm. man, at any given dinner, I mean, they will polish off quite a few beverages. And I, as you said, there's no way I could do what I do. I wouldn't have the time for it. I mean, we wouldn't have the time for the recovery. You know what I mean?
Yes, first of all, I sure do.
The hangovers alone would be, you know, unfathomable. But I said, I don't have any time to not be
on
control. You know what I mean?
I know 100% what you mean. Yes, I do. Yeah, I sure do. But I think if a guy's polishing off a bunch of booze at dinner, then he goes and plays a set. Okay, so he's 1 hour, maybe 90 minutes of doing what he's doing. But you're on. You're not on 90 minutes. You're on 8 hours, 9 hours a day.
Right.
It's a big difference, man.
Yeah.
There's a big difference. You know, when you're going 24/7 or when you're given 110% for an 8 hour block, you can't do that with any consistency partying. I can't. I couldn't anyway. I mean, I certainly couldn't. What's your non-musical superpower?
Well, it's verbal skill. I mean, I go on the radio all the time, and not as much as I used to, but I can vamp with the best of them. Let's put it that way.
You can. No, you can. You're quick-witted, man. In fact, that's why I said to my wife before I get, I said, man, I got this guy coming on, and I've got to be on top of my shit because he's going to be on top of his, you know? And I was like, you know, I had to get like 2 cups of coffee before I started because, you know, you're not a guy that – not that you're a rough guy, but you can't be timid with you because you're not going to have fun and the other guy is going to be miserable.
Right.
Right. I mean, I'm saying that in a pot. I'm very similar, to be honest with you. So, you know, I was like, you know, yeah, you're good at you got your, you know, I said it in the beginning, you're clever and quick-witted, man. And I like that. And, you know, but you got to, you have to meet the challenge when you're with someone like that, man. You can't snooze through that if it's going to be fun for anybody. I'm going to ask you 3 questions left, and then I really appreciate your time. Number one, toughest decision you ever had to make or hardest thing you ever had to do?
Just the thing that just comes to mind as you said that was years ago. You know, my goal has always just been to do the band, right? I just want to play in my band, make my music, and be able to make a living that way. Now, that does happen, but in order to be able to have a roof over my head and so on and so forth, I've had these relationships. I have the Hal Leonard thing. I have the Wildwood thing. I have the Fishman thing, so on and so forth. When my second child was – actually, she wasn't even born yet, so –
How old are your kids? How old are your kids?
My son is the oldest. He's 22. He's going to be 23 in December. My other daughter is going to be 21 in November. And then I have a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old.
Boys or girls?
Two boys, two girls. So the boys are the bookends.
Okay.
So when my son was not quite two, and my wife was just about to have my daughter, I was basically Mr. Mom. I mean, I did sessions. I had just started doing stuff for Fender, but I might do 1 or 2 weeks worth of stuff for them a year max. And I played with the band. I did sessions. So when I wasn't traveling, I was Mr. Mom. I stayed home with the kids, and my wife worked at a graphic design firm doing package design, and they had all these really big clients. So she made good dough and had all the bennies and all that other kind of stuff. But Fender asked me if I wanted to move out to Scottsdale and take this job with them. And one of the descriptions of the job was amp boy. And I thought to myself, and they said, you can move out. And my wife's like, oh my God, I can quit my job and you'll make all the money and I can stay home with the kids. And I said, yeah. But first of all, it's not all that much money. I go, and they're going to make me travel nonstop. And so you're going to be there with a newborn and a 2-year-old in the desert, which I might add, there's scorpions. And right now, if there's a little spider in the bathroom, it's the end of the world. So, and I said,
well, not only that, she doesn't know anybody.
Exactly. You won't know anybody. I go, and besides that, I am nobody's aunt boy.
Man, you know what? That alone, I would have been this. There's no way in hell you can do that. That's just, but you know what? Even if you were 21 years old, to have that as a job description is so ignorant and rude on the part of a company to do that, in my opinion.
Right. Well, to me, it seemed slightly derogatory.
Yeah, so it's very condescending.
I told him, I said, look, you know, we're just about to have a newborn. My wife's got a great job. You know, I do what I do. I got a pass. And I remember the guy called me up. He was a legend with the Fender company. He goes, calls me up. He's like, Greg, if I was your dad and you turned down this job, I'd kick your ass. I said, well, then kick away because I'm not taking it. Yeah. Because what I wanted to actually have happened, which is what ended up happening, which was basically I was the quote unquote ambassador, you know, where I went around and did stuff for him. And, you know, ambassador is a lot better than amp boy.
I mean, but how stupid is that? I mean, you mean to tell me nobody in the marketing department would have said, hey, change that to amp master? I mean, like, you know.
I mean, I don't think that would have been the that wasn't the official name that they were going to project outward, but internally.
No, but yeah, you're going to go out and be one thing and come in and be like, you know, somebody's maid.
Right.
Screw that, man. Good for you.
So I said, I mean, I don't regret it, but it was a tough one. You know, it's like, hey, how many people get asked by the biggest guitar manufacturer in the world to come out and, you know, make a living traveling around the world, playing their amps and doing the thing? But I just knew that wasn't what was going to be the best thing for me. So I didn't do it.
Good for you. It was wrong time, wrong place. And good for you. Shame on you, Fender. Person who's had the biggest influence on you.
Oh, good Lord.
That's an answer.
Yeah. Well,
a lot of people give me that as an answer.
Well, you know, certainly your parents and your upbringing, but, you know, I'd have to say probably at this point, you know, my wife, I suppose, because we're partners in crime. I there's really nothing. And my kids, I would say my family probably is my, has the most effect on me, because regardless of whatever I do career wise, it's always to the end of, well, how is it affecting the fam? You know what I mean? That's what my job is. I mean, I have to, you know, make sure that they turn out happy, healthy, and so on and so forth. So if I can pull it off by, you know, doing my music stuff, then that's fantastic. But so all of the stuff that I've, you know, from being sober guy and all that other kind of stuff was all as a result of that process. So I would have to say that. The wife and kids.
And last question, Greg, what's the best advice you've ever been given and who gave it to you?
Oh boy. Boy, that's a hard one. you know, I'm sure I'm missing it, but a buddy of mine recently said this to me, and I wish I would have been told this a long time ago, but I was complaining about a certain situation, and I was going to stand up for myself and word a strongly worded tome to various different people to make my points known. And the person said to me, he goes, well, in this situation, would you say that you're 80% satisfied in general from, you know, I'm like, yeah, I mean, I would say it's 80-20. He goes, in human interaction, the best you're ever going to get is 80-20.
Oh, that's good advice, because the other 20%, the stress it's going to give you, it's a zero-sum game. It's a losing game. So, yeah.
So I thought, you know, as much as it took me 51 years to hear that, it's like, that's pretty damn good advice.
Yeah. 80-20, that's very good advice, man. Very smart. I heard a good one the other day. It was a music executive. Beckett was his last name. I think Barry Beckett, maybe. And he was
Muscle Shoals guy.
Yes. And it was on the front of his door. I mean, I think he was a player and then he was a producer with Muscle Shoals. Right. And a bass player told me this, a session guy in Nashville. He said, be careful of the toes you step on today, because they may be attached to the ass you have to kiss tomorrow. Yeah, they may be attached to the feet of the ass you have to kiss tomorrow. I thought that was really cute. I was like, that one I'll retain as well. But listen, man, I can't thank you enough for your time. Is there anything you want to promote, or, you know, where could people find you online? How could they send you money? Where could they enjoy and experience a lot of your music and your information products?
Well, certainly my website is kind of the go-to place, which is just Greg Koch, GregKoch.com. I do have a Facebook page. There's a couple different things. There's just my personal page, which is my name. There's Greg Koch Music. There's also my Twitter, which is @mansquatch. But we also have, there's going to be a new official Koch Marshall Trio page. The label will have that up shortly, I would imagine.
On Facebook?
That'll be
Twitter. Live.
I'm sure that'll be, you know, KochMarshallTrio.com.
Cool.
So that'll be up there relatively soon. And so the record is coming out on Mascot Label Group is the name of the label, and Players Club. It's actually kind of cool. The very first record the label's coming out, the very first person the label is releasing is Tommy Emmanuel, and then it's going to be us.
Very cool.
And then after that, I think Michael Landau is going to be the next person. So,
and it's spring of 2018?
That is correct.
Awesome.
So I think it's pretty going to be February of 2018 is when we're going to get it out.
Fantastic.
And then there will be subsequent tours. So, yeah, all my different books and DVDs and my, you know, my signature guitar pedals and all that kind of crap you can get on my website. So
great.
That's the easiest place to go.
Great. And again, that's GregKoch.com, GregKoch.com.
That's it.
Any parting words, man? I learned about you a few things. Number one, you're a very sweet guy. Number two, you're a family guy. I was surprised you're married, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
because you're such a ball of energy, because people have told me that, and I'm not on public like you are, but like interpersonal, say, holy shit, like someone keeps up with you. I'm like, yeah, believe it or not, yeah, she does, and I don't know how or why, but I'm very lucky. But it's been a real pleasure, man. Honestly, appreciate you telling all the stories. Any final parting words?
You know, all I gotta say is that, with music, I think people seem to have the misconception that people are just born with stuff, and that there's, you know, I'm not a big subscriber to the great man theory. It's like it's environment, 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 and work, work, work. So if you wanna be great, you got to put the time in, and that's all there is to it.
Well said. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks again so much to Greg Koch. We really appreciate you spending time with us. I really appreciate it. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with some cool stuff for guitar players. Now be nice, go play a guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody, and I am out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.